Welcome to the latest episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast. My name is Brad Cooper, and I'll be your host. And if you've come to this episode expecting one of those boring researchers to lecture you for a while, I think you're going to be disappointed. Dr. Carla Mann is our guest today, and she crushed it. I mean, knocked it out of the park. I was, the whole time, I'm just like, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. Oh, wow. Her specialty is in endurance sports and the psychology of that, but the way she presents this is so applicable to what we're doing as health and wellness coaches. I think you're going to find it fascinating. Let me share a little bit about her background. Dr. Carla Mann is a chartered sport and exercise psychologist and senior lecturer in applied sports psychology at St. Mary's in the UK. She holds a PhD in sports psychology, where she looked at challenge and threat states in athletes. And we're going to talk a little bit about that during the conversation. Fascinating stuff. Carla has published on the topic of psychology and endurance performance in international journals, and she's edited a book titled Endurance Performance in Sport, Psychological Theory and Interventions, which is being released this May. She has a keen interest in endurance performance, inspired by her work providing brief mental support at various running events, which are called psyching teams. And that's something that's really interesting, and they're seeing some good growth with this, so you may want to take a look at that when you get a chance as well. Just a reminder that you can pull up all kinds of resources at catalystcoachinginstitute.com. Whether you're thinking about this coaching thing and you're kind of curious about it, go on there and you'll see all types of special reports and resources you can access. If you're already coaching, you've got access to continuing education, book lists, you name it, it's probably on there. So catalystcoachinginstitute.com. And we're always happy to answer questions, anything you've got. That's what we're here for. And that's results at catalystcoachinginstitute.com. Now, on with the latest episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast. All right. So, Carla, thank you so much for joining us. I'm excited about this. I got a chance to hear you at the British Psychological Society conference. You and I have traded some emails along the way. Now, the audience knows your bio from the introduction, but tell us a little bit more about your journey. How did you end up doing what you're doing today? It's pretty unique, and I think they'll find it pretty fascinating.
So I'm actually from the Netherlands, and when I was about 17, I wanted to become a sports psychologist, which back in the days, I guess, in the Netherlands wasn't really a profession that had a clear path to get to. So I ended up studying social psychology in Amsterdam, and as part of that, I also spent some time in Sweden, where I actually got some opportunities to work with sport teams. So that kind of really fueled my passion to become a sports psychologist even further. And although I never initially thought that, you know, I could do a PhD, that would be an option, I did end up doing that. So I did a PhD in the Midlands in England at Staffordshire University, where I looked at how athletes approach competition. And that's kind of really put me in a position where I'm very passionate about combining research with the kind of the applied nature of sports psychology. So I feel quite privileged that at the moment I can actually work as kind of someone who's full time in sports psychology. I never thought as a 17-year-old that was something that I was able to end up doing. But at the moment I'm quite happy with the idea that my research very much informs my practice.
Very interesting. So let's take a dive in. Now, we'll talk about the connection with health and wellness coaches as we move through here. But just initially, you've been spending a lot of time on this RESIST project. And personally, I find it fascinating just because of my personal interest. But I think a lot of our audience will find it very interesting as well. Can you give us just an overview and frankly, why it's become a focus area for you?
Yeah, so you as an endurance athlete, and I guess a lot of the listeners as well, just have a think about that question. If you've ever had that urge to stop, slow down, or even quit during an event. And a lot of people have experience. So we've done a survey with 700 plus people, and 95% of those people who responded to the survey, runners, said that they've actually experienced that urge to, you know, wanting to stop, slow down, or quit beyond what they've actually planned. And 90%, so that's an overwhelming majority of people who have those thoughts at one stage, actually said that they've given into that. So they actually slowed down beyond what they planned to do or even quit. And so what we're trying to do with the RESIST working group, which stands for Research Evaluated Endurance Strategies Intending to Support Training, is to understand what some of the reasons are for those thoughts around that urge, but also what can you actually do to deal with that. So it's the idea that we want to put forward brief psychological educational type interventions to those who do not normally have access to kind of sports psychology support. So it's really important that we kind of translate things to the wider audience. And this whole idea is based on what we call if-then planning, which is the idea that you want to kind of identify critical situations. So when you think about that urge to slow down, that might be fueled by a hill that you didn't expect to come up, a hill around a corner, and you think, oh, what's going on there? I might as well pack up and go home. Mm-hmm. Or maybe people are nervous about the pain that they're going to feel, so that kind of anticipated pain. Or maybe it's the pacing, so they started out too fast, and that would result in them not getting that personal best that they were trying to, you know, really go for. Mm-hmm. So those are what we kind of call if situations, that are kind of critical situations. But what you can do is you can think about an action plan that you put in place when that situation arrives. And that's where those brief interventions come in. So with the RESIST working group, we have a group of 7 experts who all work on endurance research. So they're all over the UK, Northern Ireland, and different areas of England, and focusing on things like pacing, the use of self-talk, attentional focus, goal setting, how to cue your form, also how to change your perception of emotions, and how you could use relaxation strategies or even use caffeine to help you overcome some of those critical situations. That's in a nutshell kind of what we're trying to do as part of the project. So I guess it'd be helpful to give you an example of like an if-then plan.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you think about a critical situation, what kind of, you know, might influence that thought is telling yourself you're not good enough. If you've ever experienced that. So that could, you know, influence what people might want to slow down. But you, instead of kind of giving into that urge, what you could do as a then, so as an action plan, is to then tell yourself that I will focus on my stride in the process of running. So what we often find is that if people are so outcome driven that during events, that's not particularly helpful. That can cause a lot of those thoughts around that urge to stop and slow down. So trying to help people to use those strategies to focus more on the process will help to kind of reduce that gap that people tend to have between a good intention and actually doing that behavior. Because you tend to have those good intentions, but it doesn't always kind of translate to behavior. And right. That's, I guess, with that if-then planning, what we're trying to help to kind of reduce that gap by understanding the reasons for that urge, but also what can you do about it? So you have that response already in place rather than on the day itself, you're kind of overwhelmed by, oh, I tell myself I'm not good enough. What am I going to do about this now?
I love it. And such great application. I don't know if you're planning a year, 2 years from now to take this next level, but my next question is how have you looked at your results or some of your initial feedback on the RESIST project? How do you think that might apply? And again, I'm thinking about these health and wellness coaches that are, I'm guessing, in the back of their mind saying, ooh, well, that's kind of what I do in coaching, this if-then stuff. Can you see some application for what you're learning with the runners in areas like nutrition or stress or life balance or sleep habits or, you know, choosing the right foods? Because it's the same concept. It's just a different activity.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that we're doing do translate. So I definitely encourage some of your, you know, the audience have a look at our website where we share some of these strategies, because what we try to do is to capture all these strategies in 45-second videos, so very brief and shortened to the point. When you ask about, you know, what kind of the lessons that people can learn, obviously the project is quite in its early stages. So what we're trying to do is to kind of map and match the reasons with the strategies a lot better. But at the moment, I would suggest that some of the lessons that people can learn is the idea that we tend to focus a lot on outcome goals. So especially when you think about running, a lot of runners have a do or die goal. And it's often very time-based. And it's not too too different from a lot of other settings. You know, we have this kind of time-based goal, and that's what we're going to go for. It's kind of that outcome do or die goal. And actually what that does is that removes us very far away from the process. And actually, when we're in the moment, it's not helpful to focus too much on the outcome. When we're in the moment, we want to focus on the process and what we're doing. And I guess that's one of the very important lessons to learn from the Resist Project, is how can we use some of those strategies to help us focus a lot more on being in the moment and have those outcome goals pushed to the background, I guess, because they're obviously quite regularly a primary focus for fueling some of those thoughts to slow down or stop. I don't know if you recognize that.
Oh, I'm guilty like crazy. But the outcome focused individual, and obviously a lot of runners, triathletes, et cetera, are very high type A, and that's their way of living. How do you move them in that direction? How do you help them see that if you'll do this, your outcome will more than likely take care of itself? Is there some precursor conversation that you can use to guide them in that thought process?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that you can do, and that's kind of another thing that we want to think about, is self-regulation. So often when we think about self-regulation, it's about, as human beings, we tend to engage ourselves in processes that move us away or towards states that we desire. And this might be a state that you desire, one of those kind of outcome goals, right? Or maybe mm-hmm. a time-based goal.
Sure.
But in fact, what we want to do is we want to not just engage in the process that prepares us for that, but we also want to engage in process to help us reflect on why something worked or didn't work. And what you can do is by using reflection as a way to identify some of those critical situations that might help to make people more aware that some of those outcome goals are not actually that helpful during a moment. So that's a first important step. So when you are having that kind of do or die or outcome-based goal, that might be helpful in your training, right? Because it can kind of track progress. But when you're in an event, there's not that much at that moment in time you can change about the training that you've done. So what's really important there is to focus on the moment. And if you have those thoughts, what can you do to deal with that? So it might be that you're using different types of self-talk to focus on pushing yourself up a hill that you didn't expect that's around the corner. Or it might be that you're focusing on actually, so if you are having that goal where you say, okay, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to engage in flexibility in my goal. So I might have a dream goal. So if everything's going very well in the day, that's the goal I'm going to go for. But actually, maybe it's much hotter than expected. So the weather conditions are a lot more challenging. So I'll go to my happy goal, a goal that I'll be okay with. And then, okay, well, I got my fueling wrong. A lot of things that happened today didn't work out. So I'm going to go to my bare minimum goal. So what it does, it helps to, I guess, remove some of the pressure and then helps to kind of go back to the process of running ultimately.
So a couple things. And again, this is incredibly applicable to what these coaches are working with. I mean, that's what they're doing with their clients every day, is helping them reflect on, the coaches aren't telling them what to do. They're helping them reflect on, how does this impact your life? What do you see happening? So outstanding in terms of the overlap with this, but my natural question, and maybe this is telling you way too much about me, is, well, how that having that happy goal seems like an easy bailout. How do you keep from letting, and maybe that's what needs to happen. Boy, you're giving me a counseling session here. So I guess my question is, how do you talk them through, okay, you have your dream goal, you have your happy goal. How soon do you let the dream goal go versus pushing through that tough phase of the race? Is it too easy to just go, okay, yeah, I'm fine. Let's just do this other thing.
I think what you're tapping into right now is the reasons why people might engage in those events, right? So for you, if it's really important to get to that kind of optimal level of performance, then there's possibly a different reason why you might be letting go. But when we think about the flexibility of the goals, you're not necessarily letting go of a goal, you're adapting your goal. So it might even be that from your dream goal, you go back to your happy goal, you go back to the dream goal again. But still what it does is you're still really much focused on the outcome. And what we're trying to do with especially the resist work is to focus back on the process.
Gotcha.
So you can kind of think, okay, how's this going? Okay, well, maybe today is not the day where the weather conditions are going to help me getting to that state, to that goal. You know, especially when you think about love endurance sure. events, there's a lot of uncontrollable factors.
Sure, sure.
So it's about accepting that there's a level of factors that you cannot control, because that's an important lesson as well.
Right.
And that can be incorporated in some of those if-then plans where, you know, if I feel that an uncontrollable factor is coming up, then this is how I'm going to deal with it. Maybe it's about acceptance or relaxation. And kind of going back to, you know, your story is, I'm very outcome oriented. I really want to kind of go for that goal. But do you feel that on the day, if you are, all you're thinking about in your brain is that goal, what does that do in terms of kind of your pacing strategy or possibly, you know, your running technique and mm-hmm. so on? So if you let that kind of goal take over, you tend to forget kind of about the process of running. And what can then happen as well is if you then have those thoughts around that urge to stop or slow down, that can have emotional consequences. So what we know is that when people give into that urge to stop or slow down beyond what they kind of planned, is they feel very kind of negative. So things like they feel quite distressed, they feel guilty, frustrated.
Waste of time.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are exactly the kind of answers that we get to, you know, what happens when you give into that. And that has those emotional consequences then affect future behavior, and that's not really helpful. And I've also kind of worked on online courses where, you know, people engage in a lot of discussions, and sometimes when people don't achieve a particular outcome goal or a personal best, this still haunts them for years, and that's not very helpful. So I guess the reason why we're trying to push so much towards, you know, during the event, try to really focus on the process, because that helps you to enjoy within reason. I mean, it is a painful event, endurance running, but enjoy that process and really understand how far you can push yourself. So maybe understanding the effort you're putting into that. And that helps again with that kind of reflection at the end and kind of understand your limits better.
So interesting. So if we pull it back to the wellness coaches, let's say they've got a client that's committed to eating nutrient dense foods. They are going to avoid the junk in the afternoon, that kind of stuff. It seems like the same concept applies. Any little tips, and I know this isn't your specific area of study, but just things that come off the top of your head that they could pull from what you're finding with the runners for that person that is, again, trying to enhance their eating patterns and they're starting to give in a little bit more. Any thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, so I think what's very helpful to consider is the kind of the feelings that come up afterwards, isn't it? So if you trying to resist maybe the urge to take that snack
mm-hmm.
and you're giving into that and you're feeling guilty about that, then it's, I guess, you tend to remember a lot of that guilt. So even that thought will already affect you. And so what's really important to remember is that when we think about those thoughts around the urge to stop and slow down, what we're not trying to do is to say you can't have those thoughts, because, you know, in our survey of, you know, 700 odd people, 95% have experienced this thought. So this thought is very common, and suppressing that isn't particularly going to help anyone. So it's more about, okay, what can you then do to deal with that? So mm-hmm. if they have those thoughts around, oh, you know, I really want to have that snack, what can you then do? So it might be that they say, oh, actually, what I'm going to do if I really want to have that snack, and, you know, maybe you can think about using a self-talk strategy mm-hmm. where you say, okay, well, I remember why I want to change my eating patterns. And therefore, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to think about maybe doing an activity with their children. So maybe what they want to do is kind of disengage their thoughts from that. So they're not trying to suppress it, but they're trying to maybe shift their focus, or they can consider the reason for changing their patterns in terms of diet. They might kind of think about their goals. So it might be that the goals they set themselves in terms of their diet are too challenging. So it has to, obviously, I'm not a nutritionist and
sure,
not
sure.
necessarily a health psychologist, but I think it is really important for them to think about how realistic is this kind of goal. So I guess what very often happens is that people go in too challenging. So they kind of aim for kind of a perfect
sure.
nutritional pattern, which when you're starting out, behavior change isn't particularly helpful. So again, I guess it's about, for a lot of the people, to understand what triggers those thoughts and be aware of that. And then trying to reduce that gap between the good intentions, because no doubt they have good intentions, but it's more, does that good intention and translate to behavior?
Outstanding. Outstanding. Before I forget, what is the website for your Resist project? You mentioned that earlier and I meant to get that so the folks would know what that is to reference some of the videos. What's the best way to find that?
So it's resist-stopping.com.
Okay. Resist-stopping, not an underscore, but a dash, stopping.com.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So when we were out in Belfast, Northern Ireland, a couple months ago for the conference, we got sneaking a run. So I know you enjoy running, you apply this stuff to your life. How has, on a personal side, and we're going to dig in a little bit deeper with that in a later question, but how has your research influenced your other pursuits in life, the non-academic stuff in your own life, in terms of how you've applied these things?
Good question. So yeah, I enjoy kind of going out for a run. And it's something that, believe it or not, I used to really dislike. I'm from a basketball background. So, you know, as a basketball player, I love the kind of short sprints, but the kind of longer stuff, I just did not see the point of, you know, going out for a run and with no kind of, you know, points to be scored at the end of it, you know, a winner or a loss. So very outcome driven. But that's changed over time. And I think one of the things that I've researched as well is a theory called self-determination theory, which is a lot about the quality of motivation. And for me, how this kind of influenced me is that I've really tried to understand the reasons why I'm doing things and trying to understand how I can move myself from less of an outcome kind of driven person to more of kind of doing things for the sheer enjoyment of it. So for me, when I go out for a run now, I prefer to go somewhere where there's a nice scenery. So it's, for me, running is really important to be outside. I live close to the river. So, you know, the river runs are fantastic. And I guess knowing the research, being involved in research in relation to motivation has really helped me to understand the impact of the quality of motivation on kind of my own well-being, if that makes sense.
Sure. Excellent. Excellent. All right. So we're going to go down another one of your paths here that I think will be incredibly interesting to the wellness coaches. You've studied the concept of challenge and threat quite a bit, and the overlap with what the coaches are doing is, I think, tremendous. Can you walk us through that as well as some of the potential application opportunities that you might see for the broader health and wellness coach setting?
Yes. Yes. So when you think about challenge and threat space, this is something that I did as part of my PhD research. So we looked into the theory of challenge and threat space in athletes. And when we think about challenge and threat space, at the core of it is that there's something at stake. So people, when you think about challenge and threat space, there is a sense of what we call a motivated performance setting. So it's, you know, when you take this to a sporting context, there's something at stake. So quite often it's winning or losing that's at stake. And so how do people kind of approach a demanding setting like that? And the notion is that, or kind of, you know, what we suggest is that people have those kind of demands of that competition, so what's at stake, but they also have a set of resources of how they feel they can deal with that. Mm-hmm. So things like self-belief, their kind of perceptions of control, and possibly also kind of the social support systems around that. And when people feel that those demands of the situation, so it might be that they're you know, running a very important event and they feel they're not kind of prepared enough for it, so they're quite high demands of a, you know, pressurized situation, and they feel that those demands outweigh their kind of resources to help them deal with that situation, they tend to experience what we call a threat state. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If they feel they got more resources than demands, kind of the scale tips the other way, then they tend to experience a challenge state. And I guess what's really unique about those kind of challenge and threat states is they're kind of accompanying cardiovascular responses, so how we respond in terms of kind of our cardiovascular system. And what happens in a challenge state is that we have an increased what we call cardiac output, so blood flow in our body. But at the same time, our vascular resistance, like blood pressure is linked to it, reduces. So our body tends to kind of get that blood flow going quite well, very simplistically said. In a stress state, on the other hand, what happens is we still have quite a bit of blood flowing through our body, but at the same time, that kind of vascular resistance increases. So our body has to work an awful lot harder to function, if you like. So you can see that there's kind of a bit of a difference in the kind of what happens to the body from a physiological perspective. And so when we think about challenge and threat states, what we try to do is to, you know, identify ways how people can get themselves into a challenge state, because what some of the research suggests is we make better decisions when we're in challenge state, better performance outcomes, but also when we think about the emotional consequences of how we feel is more efficient and more positive, if you like, in a challenge state.
So let me restate that and make sure that I'm saying this correctly. You're saying that if Brad version A sees it as a challenge, I'll actually see a difference in my cardiovascular response with no other changes from Brad version B, but Brad version B sees it as a threat. Just that perspective, all the things, and there's a lot behind that, but if I see it as a threat versus a challenge, my, not comparing me to somebody else, but within person, everything else being equal, I'll have a difference. You're able to measure that in a cardiovascular lab-based manner. Is that what you're saying?
I think you summed that up quite nicely. Yeah, it's simplistically said.
Yes.
The demand and resource ratio, the way you perceive situations, the way you approach situations, can make a difference to what actually happens in your body.
I mean, think about that. I've mainly read about the RPE, the rating of perceived exertion, but again, similar type of concept. Coaches, think about this. If your clients are seeing something as a challenge versus a threat, they're going to then see the difficulty of it, even though it's the same thing, the difficulty of it will rise a certain percentage, and they can actually measure that in the lab. I mean, that is so fascinating. Oh man, you are really bringing it home here, Carla. Let's see, what are some of the other research topics you studied over the last few years that just kind of quick version that might be something that not just in the sports performance, but in overall living and again, the kind of the well-being concept that the coaches might need to tune into. And we won't take a deep dive here because you're giving us a lot already, but just some other things for them to be aware of that come off the top of your head.
I guess one of the studies we've published a few years ago was more in an educational setting. So I've also kind of done some research in secondary, so high school settings. And what we were looking at was the quality of motivation and what are types of things that influence that. So they call it psychological needs. So things that relate to that are a sense of autonomy. So do you feel you've got any choice over your activities that you're doing? Do you feel you're competent, mm-hmm. that you can do it? And do you feel some sense of relatedness? So do you feel that you kind of relate to the people around you? So for example, in the classroom, do you feel connected to your peers, which they call psychological needs? And what we actually found in one of the studies where we asked a lot of high school students about that kind of those psychological needs, did they feel that those psychological needs were fulfilled in the classroom or possibly even frustrated? So you can see that kind of like, okay, well, we can do a lot of things to fulfill those needs. But on the other hand, actually, what might happen is that people frustrate those needs. So they actually, you know, it might be that someone's telling you not to do something, and therefore that kind of sense of autonomy is not just not fulfilled, but maybe even completely undermined. Hmm. And what we found in this study, which is quite interesting, is that that links to how people engage. And I guess that might be quite helpful for well-being coaches to be aware of. So if someone feels that their competence is being undermined actively, they tend to kind of disengage in a very passive way. So they might sit in a corner or they might not put up their hand because they feel that there's no need to do that. And on the other hand, if people feel that their autonomy, so their kind of sense of choice, very simplistically said, is being undermined, what they feel might happen, what they do is they actually actively disengaged. So it might be that they start to chat when other people are talking. It might be that they're quite disruptive or playing, you know, games on their phone to kind of actively disrupt a lesson or something like that happens. So you can see that there's kind of two different ways how people might disengage. And I guess the lesson there that I find is quite helpful also in my kind of day-to-day work when I teach students is you need to look out for that. So you need to understand why someone's disengaging, because actually what we tend to do quite often is we put the blame on the person who's disengaging, sure. Right?
Right.
But we need to look at ourselves as well, because maybe we're part of that process where we are undermining their competence, or we're undermining their, you know, sense of choice by telling them they must do this and they can't do that. And actually engaging in conversations with them to understand that kind of need satisfaction, as we call it, can be quite helpful in terms of, you know, maybe engaging people better in processes.
Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. Okay. So one of the things we try to do here consistently is, and the reason for it is, wellness coaches tend to have a lot of different voices around them, looking at headlines, hearing about weird diets and weird exercise plans and all that. So we try to bring it back to the evidence-based coach and not just the headline-based coach. Any misconceptions that you'd like to just hit some highlights on and say, you know what, just be aware of this, be aware of this. Things that you've noticed in your reading and in some of your marginal stuff that you're involved with, deceptive headlines, for example, that you see in the popular press that you think, you know, the clients of the coaches or maybe even the coaches have seen these and you just want to make sure they're not falling prey to the ridiculous nature of some of that stuff.
Yeah, see, I guess there's quite a bit of that out there, isn't there?
So much.
One of the things that sometimes bugs me a little bit is that research is portrayed, like research findings are then portrayed as being a quick fix. And I think when we think about behavior change, which obviously is a lot what the wellness coaches are working with, is anything but a quick fix.
Yes, absolutely.
And it takes time to implement some of those changes. So when we think about those if-then plans that I talked about earlier on, that's not just suddenly going to happen. You need to practice those. And it does take time to make those changes. So I think that's something I think is quite important to be aware of, because more and more people are talking about, we don't have a lot of time to do all these things. But then at the same time, you cannot cheat on time in relation to behavior change. I think for me, that's quite an important point to make. And the other thing is that when we look at kind of behavior change and kind of health and well-being, we need to really work harder in putting it all together in terms of the psychology, the physiology, the strength and conditioning, the nutrition, the sleep, the recovery, rather than looking at those as much in isolation, I guess, as we tend to do. For me, that is really important, because what we tend to do, we might tend to pick a new diet because that has seemed to work on this particular group of people. But actually, we then don't look into all these other aspects of, you know, a person, and don't really understand why a particular maybe diet or even, you know, a mental strategy might work. So to me, that's really important, to see people not just as like, I'm going to change one part, but you need to understand how that affects all of those different aspects, like the physiology, the sleep, and so on.
Excellent example. So for the coach that does want to focus their practice on evidence-based literature, research, practices in general, you obviously spend your life taking a deep dive into this stuff. For the health and wellness coach who they want to base it on that, but they don't have 3, 6, 20 hours a day to study the literature, any suggestions on how they can at least in part stay up to date on the key elements?
Yeah, I think this is something that's definitely quite close to my heart in making research available to the public. So kind of using that evidence base is really important. And I'm very much aware that we as researchers are probably not as good as we'd like to be in terms of making what we do accessible to the wider public. So obviously, this is something that we're trying to do with this project. I'm doing it with other projects like Psyching Team, but it's not necessarily that easy. So I guess my tips for that, if they are close to an institution like a university or a college, find out who's there. Is there anyone there who has an interest that aligns with yours? So is there someone who focuses on health and well-being, and can you connect with them? Because quite often people who work in institutions doing research, they're also looking for participants. So there's kind of a win-win situation quite potentially there. And that will help you to ask them questions like, what do some of these terms or theories actually mean in kind of a practical context? So I guess that's my first tip, is see if there's anyone at a local institution so you can connect with. Social media is big, obviously. Think about, you know, power of maybe Twitter, Instagram, and so on. Can you find researchers on those bits of social media? Can you follow them? And quite often, they might have papers that they find important that they post online, and you can possibly, you know, try to start reading them or ask them questions about it if you struggle with some of the content of it, so to make it accessible to you. And I think that's really important, and it's definitely an agenda that's really important for researchers to make their content available to, you know, the wide public. Why else are we doing research? Well,
thank
at least that's my perception. And so see if there's any online courses. So last year, I've been part of an online, what they call massive open online course. Mm-hmm. Future Learn is a website that offers these types of things. It's a lot of other online delivers. I think you have them on your website as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important to kind of engage in that, because quite often researchers are involved in the development of some of those courses. So you get access to that material, but usually in a bit of a more user-friendly way. So you don't have to read 6 hours a day to understand it or to get your head around it. And I guess to plug a book that I've edited, what I've tried to do is I edited a book on the psychology of endurance performance, where we combine kind of psychological theory and interventions. And what we try to do is to make that accessible to a wider public, so not just academics and students at universities, but also for coaches and athletes themselves. So look out for those types of sources, so like popular science books.
Well, let's repeat that book title. It's The Psychology of Endurance Performance. Is that correct?
Endurance Performance in Sport, Psychological Theory and Interventions.
Perfect. Very good. Great tips. Okay, so now we're going to turn the mirror around a little bit. We like to give our listeners a chance to get to know the guest on a little bit more of a personal level. So if you're willing, any area of well-being in your own life that you're currently working on, you don't have it dialed in, you haven't completely figured it out, that you'd be willing to share, anything from life balance to exercise, nutrition, sleep, whatever, struggles, successes, kind of just sharing your current journey with us and how you're going about it.
Yeah, very interesting question. I think one of the things that from a very little girl already been haunting me, I guess, is my lack of patience. So I've always been very outcome driven. Even when I was very young, I wanted to beat everyone else in whatever I was doing. And that's something that helped me on my journey because sure. I've been, you know, very kind of driven in terms of, you know, I knew what I wanted to do from the age of 17, and I would just make sure I'd get there no matter what. And so it's been helpful. But on the other hand, what it prevented me from doing is actually focusing a little bit more on the journey. And what I've done a few years ago is I kind of made a conscious decision to try to be more kind of in the present moment. And I invested in a mindfulness cognitive behavioral therapy course where I learned to do that with a group of other people. So I actually immersed myself in that rather than, you know, relying on what I tend to do is like reading books or using kind of online resources. I kind of made a conscious effort to go out and actually do it with other people and to kind of get that instant feedback. You know, so one of the things that we did as part of this course was looking outside of the window and focus on one particular point for 3 minutes. So knowing my lack of patience, if I were to do that at home, I probably wouldn't have managed to kind of look at that for 3 minutes. But I did it and I found it was really calming me down, and I tended to notice all sorts of things. I think I was focusing on a brick. And normally when you look at a brick, you don't necessarily seem to notice the different colors and maybe, you know, some of the plants that grow out of it, because you just normally walk past it or you look at the building as a whole. So for me, that was a very small thing that made actually quite a big difference. And as a result, I've actually been a lot more patient over, it's a process. Working on it, but it's helped me to be a lot calmer and also be less kind of outcome driven, and making more of an effort to really focus on the process has really helped me. And within that, don't feel bad if you're missing out on opportunity. That's okay. You're still focusing on, you know, a journey towards right. somewhere, and that's okay. So I guess that's a bit of a personal insight as to what kind of changes I've tried to make in the last couple of years.
That's a wonderful example. I'm sure I think you're counseling me while we're doing this. That definitely hits home, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners are in the same boat. So outstanding example. Thank you. Carl, this has been so good. The last question, just kind of your chance to wrap anything up. Any final words of wisdom, either for current wellness coaches that are, you know, they've got their clients they're working with, or people that are maybe thinking about it and getting to that realm? Just any final thoughts, advice, anything else you'd like to share that you didn't get a chance to share up to this point?
I think for people working in the environment, what I find is quite important is try to listen to your client and put yourself in their shoes. So with that, kind of try to give them ownership over what they're doing and be okay with not necessarily understanding their experiences, because everyone comes from a different background, mm-hmm. aren't they? Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, you can ask them to explain that. And one of the things that from a kind of practical perspective as a sports psychologist, I sometimes do is using drawings or pictures to do that. So that's maybe something for wellness coaches to consider. Another thing that I kind of wanted to mention the previous one, but overlooked, is the power of smiling is quite important as well. I think, you know, Kipchoge talked about that in his world record attempt.
Yeah.
And I think generally that's quite an important thing and something to consider implementing in their practice when they're working with clients.
Great example. And for those of you not familiar with Kipchoge, he's the gentleman who was part of the Nike 2-hour marathon and then turned around, I believe it's Berlin, that he turned around and just about knocked, what, a minute and a half off, which typically takes 15 to 20 years to happen. And he did it over a 2-year period. So folks, if you've not seen the documentary on the Nike 2-hour marathon project, you can see exactly what Carl is talking about as he comes into even the final, I think it's up until the final mile, he's smiling. This is a guy running 4:35 approximately per mile for 26.2 miles, far ahead of anyone in the history of the world has done. And yet he's smiling up until the last, and I can't remember, Carl, it's like the last 800 meters or mile, he holds that. And it's incredible when you see that happening. So great example. Carl, thank you so much. This was so good. I know people are going to dive into this and probably listen to it a couple times to pull all the nuggets out of here. But thank you for spending the time with us today and look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you for having me.
So that brings us to the close of another episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast. I have a feeling at least a handful of you are out there thinking, why were my professors never that interesting? Wasn't that awesome? A couple of key takeaways, just some things that I wrote down as I was going through it. The if-then planning. She talked about the power of doing that, where you think through, if this happens, then that's what I'll do. Obviously, it applies to racing, training, but it applies so much to what we're doing as wellness coaches as well. She talked a lot about being in the moment, and you're hearing a lot about that in general, but this whole focus on process versus outcome, very, very powerful. And I'm saying that as a guy who is not good at applying that, but the concept, very, very powerful. We talked about staying up to date on the research so you can get beyond the fads, the headlines, the things that are in your face all the time. And she mentioned a few different ideas, but one of the simple ones you can apply is to access Twitter and access it in the right way. There are so many ridiculous things on Twitter. You've got to be careful. But she talked about follow some researchers that you respect. Follow some researchers that are covering topics that you believe in, that you're wanting to learn more about. If you'd like to follow Carla, she is at Carla Mann, so CarlaMeijen. If you'd like to follow me, I'm at Catalyst, the number 2, Thrive. So Catalyst to Thrive. And both of us, our focus is very similar. Her background's much more research intense, but the focus is the same. We're trying to post information, human performance ideas, concepts, tips, research study links, those kinds of things. So, and one of the nice things about Twitter is you can literally go to, for example, Carla's account, you can pull her up and then look and see who she's following. And then maybe you want to follow the same people. So nice route to go if you do it correctly. Otherwise, it can just become another disaster aspect in terms of too many fads that are thrown in your face again. A couple of announcements. We've got, obviously, the retreat is in hot pursuit right now. We just finalized the schedule and who's going to be speaking there. So real excited about that. We also have an upcoming coaching certification on the same website, catalystcoachinginstitute.com. And one thing I don't think I've ever mentioned before is if you'd like to bring the fast track to you, so your city, your town, your state, let us know. We are scheduling a few of those and happy to talk to you about the details there. As always, thanks for spreading the news. Thanks for subscribing. I understand that makes a big difference in terms of how iTunes treats all this. And thanks for making a difference. Thanks for doing what you do. So until next time, let's all keep working towards better than yesterday, not only for ourselves, but also for our clients, our families, our communities. Make it a great day, and I look forward to speaking with you soon on the next episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast.